distributing the future broadcast January 27, 2006, wiretapping, open source in Brazil, and attenuation.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we'll bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week, Jack Harrington talks to the EFF's Brad Templeton about wiretapping. Brazilian technologist Bruno Souza explains why software freedom is important in his country. Rael Dornfest wants to turn down the volume on all the noise in his various inboxes. And Derek Story and Chuck Toporek report from Macworld. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Host your next meeting online with GoToMeeting. Everyone logs on to your meeting during your conference call so they see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's like meeting in person, but less expensive and time-consuming. With GoToMeeting, you can demo products, present, or train just like you're in the same room. GoToMeeting has a low, flat monthly rate, so meet as often as you want for as long as you need. Try it free today at gotomeeting.com/DTF. That's gotomeeting.com/DTF. As the first O'Reilly Emerging Telephony Conference was coming to a close, Podcasting Hacks author Jack Harrington caught up with Electronic Frontier Foundation Chairman of the Board Brad Templeton. The two discuss wiretapping. How is the government listening into your phone calls, whether you make them on a landline or a cell phone? What's coming next for voice over IP applications, and why, at least for now, you might want to use Skype when privacy is important to you? Templeton talks about action the EFF is considering regarding the NSA wiretapping and tells Harrington about what he might do to turn off or confuse wiretaps. Wiretapping isn't what you might remember from old spy movies. There's nobody shimmying up a pole in the night or attaching bugs to the lamp on your nightstand. At least in the U.S., there are laws which make it technically easy for your phone to be tapped. Templeton explains.
We've been very concerned about the laws that require wiretapping to be built into all telephony and now all voice over IP carriers that are talking to the PSTN. We think that's going to put a serious barrier to innovation in the industry and hurt the small guys, and hurts the big guys a little bit, but big guys like it when the little guys get hurt because then they don't get competitors that innovate against them, and that's a bad environment.
So we've heard a lot about NSA wiretapping recently. So
really? No, I hadn't.
Yeah.
No, the NSA is not wiretapping it. No, yeah. We certainly have. This may surprise you. They actually haven't disclosed the technical details of what they're doing, and of course, in fact, they didn't want to disclose anything at all. So a lot of people, security experts, have speculated about what might be going on. It's hopefully informed speculation, but no, obviously neither confirmed nor denied that there's widespread surveillance going on, sort of blanket looking at all phone records, who's calling who, trying to find the patterns in that, possibly even the legendary software that does voice recognition and listens to calls and waits until you say fly plane into World Trade Center.
Echelon.
Yeah. Well, no, Echelon is actually the name for a program that possibly was doing that, but was doing it by paying foreign spy agencies, which are not bound to not listen to Americans. As you may or may not know, the NSA was, until recently, forbidden to spy on Americans. That's the job of the FBI. But the FBI is supposed to follow its own rules and its own warrants. And until that revelation that this had changed, the speculation, again, neither confirmed nor denied, was that the U.S. government gave lots of money to the Canadian CSE, the British MI6, and said, listen, here's some money. We would never ask you to spy on Americans, but since it's okay for you to do that under your law, if you happen to learn something, of course, now the president just told the NSA, hey, go ahead, spy on Americans. Clearly, wiretapping is intended to be used in legal wiretaps, where a judge has issued a warrant saying, here is a person's phone, you are allowed to tap it. And they've tended to say, well, you guys are paranoid about this being abused. It's not going to be abused. There's all these safeguards and stuff like that. As we've just had a very clear example of why we need to be worried about abuse of wiretap technology.
Is there a way that I can protect myself from being tapped?
Well, yes, encrypt. I would actually recommend at this point Skype. Now, of course, Skype's all proprietary, and there's a number of scary things about that, but I'll tell you one thing that Skype has going for it. Skype did their encryption right. Most people aren't even aware it's there. Every single Skype call is encrypted, and because every Skype call is encrypted, it's not even suspicious that you're encrypting. If you were to use I also like Phil Zimmerman's encrypting phone, which was spoken about at this conference. But the truth is, if you were to use that phone, you mark yourself as someone who's concerned about encryption. If you use Skype, you're just a Skype user. You're one of millions of Skype users. And we haven't had the ability to test the quality of the encryption in Skype because it is a proprietary system, and that's to be concerned about. But I'd rather have that than the no encryption at all that, unfortunately, most voice over IP providers give you.
Right. And voice over analog.
The whole raft, yeah.
So on a cell phone, is that easy to hack?
Well, there is some encryption on cell phones now. It took a long time coming, and there's also, generally believed that not so difficult for them to wiretap it. Now, in addition, Kalia is built into all of the regular phone networks, including the cell phone networks and the regular phone networks, and so that they can come in and give an order and say we're tapping the cell phone.
So what is Kalia?
Kalia stands for Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act, and it was a law from about 13 years ago, which was put in place for ordinary telephone systems as they moved digitally, not for voice over IP. When the law was passed, it said, don't worry, this doesn't apply to the Internet and information systems. But, of course, now everyone's making phone calls to the Internet. Department of Justice is saying they're afraid that the standard litany of child pornographers, harassers, terrorists, and mobsters will all be using voice over IP to escape being wiretapped, and so it is the duty of the voice over IP industry to do the work of the police in helping deliver the wiretap. It's sort of like saying, you in buying equipment should also pay for the ability for it to be used against you. When you allow laws of this type to be in place, you create a regime where one must ask permission to innovate. And when you ask permission to innovate, it is just remarkable how dramatic the effect on innovation is. It just astounds me in some ways, because in some cases they'll say, what's your worry? I just have to fill out a form. It's just amazing how much less is done when you've got to fill out a form and get a bureaucrat to approve you. Now, it's even worse if the bureaucrats who are approving you have some reason to slow down those they don't like. But even when they don't even have that reason, it's remarkable how much innovation is slowed down by the requirement to get permission. This is normally a good country for innovation.
Oh, absolutely.
So a lot of the places in other countries, the problem is that you do need more permission to innovate in business. The United States, many people feel, has the economic prosperity that it does, because, at least in the old days, you could do a lot of business without having to get permission. You could come up with new business models, new products, new ideas, and you just did them, and you put them in front of the customer, and if the customer bought it, you got rich. And in other places, you had to bribe the right people and fill out the right paperwork. And again, even a small little hump has a remarkable effect.
So the ACLU has something moving on this NSA wiretapping. Is this something that the EFF is thinking about moving on?
Yes, we are.
And where are you with that?
I can neither confirm nor deny the existence of our actions against the wiretapping.
What are you thinking about?
Oh, no, we're definitely thinking about it. And in fact, we're supporting the other parties who have been doing it. The ACLU released one recently, and we want them to win, and we want the things that we'll do to win, too.
Okay. And there's no way that I...
Ask me again next Tuesday, I think.
Oh, wow. And there's nothing that I can do as a citizen to figure out if I've been wiretapped or...
Well, figure out if you've been wiretapped. Actually, yes.
Really?
The old traditional wiretapping system, even the Kalia wiretapping system, a friend of mine, Matt Blaze, well-known cryptographer, recently discovered vulnerability in this system that you can turn off their wiretaps. Or confuse them if you want to. So, go type Matt Blaze and wiretap into your favorite search engine, and you'll probably be directed to that. It's a little bit complex to be explained. Well, the very simple version is that if you've seen a touchtone keypad, it has four rows and three columns. Technically, it has four columns. I just don't make the fourth column. And there's a key on there, which is called the C. The other column is ABCD. The touch tone, it's one of the touch tones, it's just not one that you can... Anyway, if you were to make that touch tone very quietly in the background, it turns off wiretapping equipment. Basically, all the wiretapping equipment they checked.
Brad Templeton, chairman of the board of the EFF, interviewed by Jack Harrington. You'll find links in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. Bruno Souza talks to us about open source in his home country of Brazil. Java developers may know Bruno from his yearly trips to Java 1. He's easily identifiable as he wears the Brazilian flag with pride as a cape. He's worked with the Brazilian government to help them understand the importance of open source code to both coders and to end users. In this first part of our discussion, Bruno explains that the appeal of open source is in the freedom that it brings.
The reason why Brazil has chosen open source as the way to go is that the country is always looking for choice, for a way to be able to decide our own future. I think that, first of all, Brazil has what I have been calling for quite some time a open source dot license culture. For a long time, and even today, we exchange software, we exchange code. You know, if we work in different companies and I call you and say, I'm needing this component, you're just going to send it to me, right? It's very rare for somebody to say, oh, no, I have this component, but that's my own company, you know, that's a company property, I can't send that to you. And this has been going on for a long time. And it's simply the way we work, you know. It's simply a very open way. It's not try to be secretive. It's very easy to get companies to go talk and show details of their technology in trade shows, for example. So it's not a culture that's trying to keep a lot of secrets. So it seems that we have been doing this sharing code without license attached to it. And then suddenly somebody comes up and say, hey, if you put this license here, then you can share for everybody. And say, what's really the difference? And a lot of people are realizing that what they're doing before was it was kind of a one-to-one thing, right? I would call you and you'd send the code to me. But then you never told me that I could share this code to somebody else. And then once you put an open source license to it, then it's clear that you can share this with other people. It's clear that it's not a one-to-one. It's not because I like you that I'm sending it to you. It's to anyone that wants to use it. So I think that open source is kind of putting this whole sharing culture into a much easier way to cope with, and much more with all the legal backing for that. Brazil is a very large country, so it's large. It's one of the largest countries in land in the world, and it has a large population. So even if it's just a small portion of it decides to develop software, it's already large enough to have a lot of people participate in open source, for example. But for the large amount of people that don't develop code, there are a few things that they're interesting. And one of them is localization of software. There is a whole lot of software that's not translated to Portuguese, and there are several reasons for that. But one of them is that software is if there's software that's done outside of Brazil, it's quite expensive in Brazil because the conversion between dollars and reals it's really bad on our side. So if you bring any kind of software to Brazil, it's usually very expensive. And so it's normally it's easier for you to develop in the country in-house software that is localized. So I think that's a lot of users are interested in open source because then they can have this software that everybody's using. And they can help localize that, but that's not only that. I think that one of the advantages that Brazil has is that the words free software translated to Portuguese, it's actually software livre, and livre means freedom. So actually, the word we use is software freedom, and so freedom is something that everybody attaches to real easily. So you can actually tell even in end users that by choosing open source, you're choosing freedom, and that's exactly what the things we're looking for: freedom to choose. So I think that this part kind of got very well with everybody, especially inside the government. When you get to a in developing country government, and you show the story about freedom, and how this can help you keep the sovereignty of the country, then it's something that politicians understand really quick. And one thing that the open source community in Brazil was able to do very well was to involve not only the developers, not only the technical guys, but to involve you know, politicians, lawyers, all areas of the culture, you know, things like even musicians are putting music under Creative Commons, for example. So it's a whole culture of sharing the knowledge that's attracting a lot of people to it. Since free is not the word we use the word freedom, right, for software livre, that actually means that if you just say, okay, I'm going to give it to you for free, it doesn't have the same meaning of I'm going to give you freedom, right? So there is a lot of companies that have come off this, okay, I'll give you for free, you know, I'm not going to charge you anything. But that has not changed the idea that you know, the open source is a good thing.
Bruno Sosa recorded at the European Open Source Conference in Amsterdam. One of the keynoters at EuroOSCON was O'Reilly Media's CTO, Rael Dornfest. Where once we were overwhelmed by our email inbox, we now have RSS feeds, social networks, and buddy lists bringing countless pings for attention. Rael appreciates all of this attention economy, but thinks we're in need of applications that help us attenuate all of this data that's clamoring for our attention.
There's been much said over the past couple of years about the data web, this concept of breaking data free of web pages and sort of moving on and using this data and recombining this data and remixing this data, and things like the network effects, putting the data onto the network and thereby increasing the value of the network for everybody else on it. And the wisdom of crowds, this notion that at some point the network will achieve some form of intelligence and bring that to bear on your spam problems and your email problems and various different problems you might be having, as well as just basically raising the wisdom of the network as a whole. It's just basically, it's happening at an alarming rate. It's stuffing our inboxes, our RSS readers, desktops, file systems, iPods, DVDs. We're downloading, recording, etc., more movies than we could ever possibly imagine watching. But most alarmingly, it's stuffing every moment of our waking consciousness. So anyway, so we grit our teeth and open the morning's email, 146 messages, and we summarily ignore the 1,298 RSS items, the 190-odd bloggers that we subscribe to have managed to generate since we went to bed the night before. And then there's aggregation, this sort of promise of subscribing to and pooling all the various data sources in one place, and somehow or other providing a lens through which we can see more information faster in a more efficient manner. Right? Effectively, it's email to world, from world, CC world. It's effectively what RSS feeds are. Now, Blogline's creator Mark Fletcher actually likes this comparison and says that effectively an RSS aggregator is sort of like a universal inbox. Why should you just aggregate feeds? You should be able to track events and packages and other bits and bobs that don't actually belong in your email inbox. Essentially, it's shifting the problem from one box to another. You know, I already have one inbox that's overflowing. I don't actually need two inboxes that are overflowing. And there's no real story weaved through the mess, if you will, as good as portions of the mess may be. And RSS aggregators, as much as they're seen as, you know, as good as email or ways to sift through this stuff, they're scarcely better than email. It's just not enough. Now, I pick on RSS aggregators and readers perhaps more than I should, but that said, they are kind of the hello world. But there are also many other culprits of aggregation is the attenuation fallacy. I'll start with this one. It's basically the realization that spam is not binary, right? I get very little spam, but I get a lot of that spam-ish, right? I think everybody gets that. It's all those conversations that you read daily that come into your inbox. You know, they're not interesting that day, or you'd rather put them off or whatever. And there's no real tool to do that. There are no heuristics. There's no spam filter. There's no junk keyboard shortcut that says, this is not really junk, but it's just not interesting today. Bring it back tomorrow if it's still around. And why not apply some of the learning that we've got some spam filters to actually figure out next time. He tends to throw away mail from this person to that group or from that group in general. And maybe not throw it away, but put it aside or mark it as something they might not be that interested in. It doesn't need to be something as complex as machine learning involved. It's just essentially, every time I get mail to this group, I tend to hide it away. Another one is this notion that groups are normalized somehow. Right, my buddy list. Despite everybody's lamenting, you can't do simple things like say, I don't want these people to see me online today, or I'm logging into this sort of realm. Only these people should see me. And we have these hacks to get around it, but again, normal people don't have those. And there are arbitrary limits on the number of buddies you can have. I routinely have to do sort of an audit of buddies. You know, I'd like to add you today, but that means I have to kill off somebody else. Speaking of blunt instruments, social networks bear absolutely no resemblance to anything vaguely social. The binary, are you my friend, yes or no? I don't know how I'd ever answer that question. There's no concept of motion between groups, right? I mean, there's some days I spend more time with some people and some days I spend more time with other people. But social networks, as they're built, are accretive, right? It's like waking up every morning and all 350 people you've ever met, or at least say they've met you, are standing in your living room along with all 350 people that they supposedly know, and Mark Cantor standing dead center. Another notion is this embrace constraints, and I use actually here Backpack to present this because Backpack by 37 Signals and David Heinemeier Hansen. Simple applications means less confusion, fewer support problems, fewer help files. It just sort of makes sense. Especially for the apps they're building. So they're rethinking some of the suites of apps that we run on our desktops that are massive and bring them down to a sizable chunk. Apple embraced and extended constraints with its iPod, right? Limited storage capacity, no room for a keyboard, tiny screens. They built an interface which looks remarkably Mac-like, even though it's not really Mac-like. And they built out an end-to-end network for the thing. They basically built out iTunes as the outboard brain for the iPod. It's a place to store the information that you need, manage information, so you don't have to manage it on this little tiny click wheel device. So there's, you know, those constraints are actually rather powerful. Something I've been thinking about a lot recently, and that is that everyone scribbles in the margins. Stickies, bookmark and annotate our offline reading. They're all over our screens, all over our walls. They're inspiration and notes and to-dos and God knows what else. They're just all over the place. And there's sort of endearing little yellow pointers to things. Right? That's why actually programmers actually like stickies. And there are a lot of programmers who have stickies all over the place, no matter how many tracking systems they have. So they like these little pointers to objects and to ideas and to actions, and sometimes just to inspiration. And they endure because there's always the need for a margin to scribble in. Right? No matter how integrated your app, no matter how comprehensive your framework, no matter how flexible your API, there's always a need to kind of hack around the borders to build out things. I mean, that's what blogging is all about, and wikis. Wikis take it a step further, and they actually let you write in line as well and pretty much ignore the borders, the margins. And the remixing media and open source. While the whole concept of scripting in the margins may be anathema, may seem anathema to what I'm talking about in terms of attenuating and in terms of pushing interfaces in a direction of being able to more easily manage data where stickies are kind of all over the place, it really isn't. I mean, it's in the margins that the innovation happens, right? It really is. I mean, open source has been in the margins for a long time. The innovation has happened. But there comes a time when you want to push it towards the center. You want to do a little bit of cleanup. And we're just at that point right now, I think, especially with all the data that we're producing with EVDB and upcoming, starting to spew calendaring data along with our RSS data. I mean, the number of people I speak to around eTech, and I said, would you like to be on the program committee? And they said, oh, I barely have enough time to keep up with my RSS feeds. And they're feeling guilty about this. It's not mailed to you. You don't have to read it. But you kind of want to keep up. And reverse chronological order is not an ideal way of thinking about the world. So we have to rethink where some of these margins lie and what to incorporate and what to discard. And it'll be a little messy for a while. I mean, sure it will. It always is. But, you know, showing you some of my pet pivot points, I think that I'm definitely going to attack some of these. And I think that you can. I mean, there's some, again, quoting 37 Signals, but basically there are enough small problems to solve without having to go after the large ones. Right? There's some very simple pivot points that you can put into place that really can make some of this stuff manageable. More is now 40% less.
Rail Dornfest will further explore, quote, the applications and services, interface overhauls and algorithmic underpinnings, technological hacks and etiquette tweaks of what we call the attention economy at the O'Reilly Emerging Technology Conference in San Diego, March 6th through 9th. As always, you'll find links in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. We wrap up this edition of Distributing the Future with a look back at the Macworld Expo. The first thing that caught the attention of O'Reilly senior book editor Chuck Toporek was the hardware announcements.
Well, I think some of the bigger announcements obviously were the MacBook Pro, where Apple finally announced that we're getting a faster Intel-based PowerBook / now MacBook. The fact that we're now, you know, he introduced both the iMac and the new MacBook Pro here at Macworld shows something I think really significant for Apple. It's a big move for them, because the fact that they let out their laptop line with, you know, the 15-inch MacBook Pro, I think is a really smart strategic move for them, because it clearly states that, you know, they knew that this was a lacking feature for them, and they're pushing forward with it. So now it'll be interesting to see how they make the rest of the hardware product line evolve over the next year, because Jobs said that that's one of their goals. Is, you know, initially they were thinking that they're going to get all of their hardware over to Intel by mid-2007, and he says now we've accelerated that schedule and we're going to get it all done this year. You know, when you look at some of the stuff that Apple does, you know, there's big conferences that they exhibit at every year, and you know, the next big show for Apple, in my view, is NAB, which is the National Association of Broadcasters conference that's in Vegas every year, and it's usually in the first week in April. And during the keynote, Steve Jobs made this announcement that, you know, if you have one of the Pro apps, Final Cut Pro Studio or Final Cut Studio, Logic Pro, or Aperture, that you can, in March, you can swap those discs out for universal binary discs for $49 each. You know, if they're going to release universal binaries in March, that means there's got to be hardware that's going to come to run that software. So, you know, my feeling was, you know, look to April. You know, and Steve Jobs said that, you know, at the very end of his keynote, he said April 1st of this year marks the 30th anniversary of the founding of Apple. You know, he said, you know, for them it was sort of a joke when they did it, but, and he also said that, you know, they're not sure how they're going to celebrate it this year. So, you know, maybe April Fool's Day this year we can be looking to see a new Intel-based Power Mac line. And so then the next question is, you know, what is that going to be called? Because, you know, we've seen them stick with the iMac, but they've switched the PowerBook over to the MacBook Pro. So what are they going to call the Power Macs? Are they going to call them Mac Macs? Or, you know, so it'll be interesting to see how they rename that product line. So I think, you know, everybody should keep their eye on end of March, beginning of April, and pay attention to all the news feeds coming off of NAB, because Apple's going to be doing some big stuff around then. I strongly believe that. With Apple's plans to have all of their hardware shifted over by the end of the year, you know, the last possible time that Apple would want to release a new piece of hardware would be around Thanksgiving, because they want to have something that's available for sale for for the end of this year's holiday season.
Senior editor Chuck Toporek. Meanwhile, Mac Dev Center editor Derek Story is also a professional photographer. His favorite new product from Apple was iPhoto 6.
For me, as a digital photography guy, I just think what they've done with iPhoto 6 as part of iLife is really exciting, and I think is probably being a little bit overshadowed because of the hardware announcements. They've made it easy to do photo editing, which is sorting, in iPhoto, and they borrowed some of the best features from Aperture, which is basically a $500 application. They put it in iPhoto, which costs $79, and it has all the other applications bundled with it. So now you can edit in full screen mode. What that means is that you get to eliminate all the clutter of the UI and just look at your photo against a black background. And then if you want, you can bring in up to 8 photos total, side by side, without any clutter, zoom in, zoom out, and figure out which one is the best one, mark it accordingly, and then move on to the next. This is really high-end photo editing at a very, you know, low entry price. I'm thrilled about it. I think they're doing a great job in this space.
Thanks to Derek Story and Chuck Toporek for their comments on Macworld. Thanks also to Rael Dornfest, Bruno Souza, Brad Templeton, and Jack Harrington. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting, online meetings made easy. Try it free at gotomeeting.com/DTF. Thanks to all of you who've emailed or phoned in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@oreilly.com or phone our listener line at 206-350-0383. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at www.batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.